good. Thanks everybody for sticking it out. It's a long day for the summit, but it's really good info and really great to hear all these different perspectives. And I hope it's got y'all excited as it does me for spring and what we're going to be trying to grow in the next the coming season here. So many good ideas. All right, the stream is working, so let me go do a proper introduction here. All right. Hello and welcome to the Starting and Operating a Successful Permaculture Nursery Summit, brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. Today's summit is brought to you by PINA members and for PINA members, and of course, the greater permaculture community. I'm Jesse, and I'll be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the unparalleled Ken Esmus. Presenting on the topic of practical marketing, develop and create repositories of permaculture plants for the public. Ken is the founder of Oikos Tree Crops and has spent over 30 years cultivating diverse, resilient, and nutritious food plants. His journey began in childhood, learning tree farming from his father, and evolved into a passion for exploring new food crops and wild counterparts of popular cultivars. After earning a biology degree, Ken started his tree farm in 1982, focusing on unique fruits, nuts, and obscure food crops. His goal was to recreate the flavors of wild blueberries and strawberries from his family farm, and through Oikos Tree Crops, he has collected, grown, and shared genetically diverse seed strains. Ken's approach to farming emphasizes biodiversity, cultivating populations of genetically varied plants that can adapt to changing climates and ecological pressures. By offering an alternative to conventional farming, Oikos Tree Crops focuses on plants that are ecologically integrated and thrive in diverse environments while educating others on the importance of biodiversity in agriculture. Welcome, Ken. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's our pleasure, absolutely. And the question I always start with in this whole summit is what I'm going to ask you now, which is what impact has permaculture had on your life?
Well, it gave a name really to my personal experience in my life. So when I read those first few books by Bill Mollison, I was like, oh my God, this answers so many questions and gives a voice for my personal experience about nature, agriculture, and life in general. So that's what I appreciated about permaculture and why it's so important to me.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And then similar question, but more honed in on like the nursery. If somebody were just becoming aware of permaculture or just took a permaculture course and they are considering like, oh, maybe I should start a nursery as part of my livelihood, what might you say as like why the nursery business?
That's a good question. Well, the nursery business I learned about from the Christmas tree farms because Christmas trees were really the first tree crop. They were inexpensive. You could buy them very inexpensively. You could plant them on land that was rather abandoned. It wasn't being used for anything else. And you needed to have some knowledge on pruning and spraying, et cetera, but not a lot. And the average person could do that. So it's really kind of a stepping stone for me as far as having a tree crop that could grow untended for the most part. And I was curious to know, are there other food plants like this that you could do the same thing for that no one has really thought much about? And so that kind of got me into the tree and the nursery business because when I graduated from college, I took jobs in those fields. I worked in a retail garden center for a year or so, and also a wholesale company. And it was through there that I began to get to know the bigger picture of other nurseries here in southwestern Michigan. So that's how that got started.
Okay, that's perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to hearing sort of lessons learned from all your years running a permaculture nursery, essentially.
Sure.
So I'll let you take it away with the presentation. I'm here in the background if you need anything.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go over some history of my farm a little bit and just talk about what I did and what it is now a little bit. And then we'll go to some of the plants that I worked on and how those can be a springboard or give you ideas on working with other plants as well, because it varies quite a bit on what I've done.
Perfect.
So the first thing was when I started my farm in the early 80s, At that time, it was mail order business. So I was curious about the mail order business, and I read as much as I could about that so I could create a nursery that was a mail order company. So with that in mind, I was like, well, I got to produce a catalog. I've got to build a mailing list. I got to send the catalog out. And I did that. And so, I had a lot of interesting catalogs I produced over the years. Some of them were very simple. Different. This is a big one here, and here's a smaller one which had just vegetables. And then, I went to full color there, and we started using artwork that that I hired an artist, local artist, to do. And so it was a lot of inter it was really interesting. Here's some of my photography that I highlighted when I went to color. I still had a black and white inside. But anyway, this type of production of a catalog is very normal. And in that time, it was really the only thing that you could do. But today, this is the vinyl years. No one is going to be the catalog is just, it's very bulky. It takes a lot of resources to produce. And so now, today, I got this just, I think about 2 months ago. I was on Instagram and there was a guy there I met named Matt Peppers. And Matt grows peppers. Now, I always want to know the backstory of people. Like, I know they're running the nursery stuff, but I'm like, what, how did you get into this? And Matt worked in the fishing industry in Alaska. Then he moved down to Indiana. He got married. He's a stay-at-home father, and he began to produce pepper seeds. And so he wanted some pepper that I had. And I was like, yeah, I'll send you the seeds. You can exchange it. And look what I got in return. Like, I got a whole thing of peppers here. It was just amazing. Look at, and it was
Wow.
just like, yeah, I know. And I was like, and it's got his logo on there, mattspeppers.com. He sells on Instagram. And I was like, this is the future of the nursery business, really, in the seed business. It's kind of all compact. His backyard, I think, is just pepper plants, from what I could tell. He has a special pepper that he calls Matapino, that is a variegated jalapeno pepper. And so he spent a little time publishing and doing the artwork for this, which is kind of nice. So this is really the show. The nursery could be your showcase, I guess, what I'm saying, to your creativity, to the arts, to the sciences, and how you're gonna people want to come to you for something. It's the plants, yes, but people are very curious about to know about your life. What are you doing? And a lot of plant nurseries don't have people pictures in them. There, it's kind of missing. And I was one of those. I never put my picture in there. Once in a while, I would do it, but eventually I realized I needed to put more people pictures in there. And that's really kind of gives people a comfort level knowing, especially these days, using your art, using your music, whatever it is that you're involved with, to incorporate that into the nursery. And this gives it a separate, it's a very crowded market. So this is the problem you really run into. If you can, you can create repositories of special plants that you feel passionate about, and you can do that in a small place. And you do need to have patience and understand, plants a little bit, but it's best if you know nothing about plant breeding, because I found that people who enjoy plants, who love plants, they seem to make more progress in the development of the plants. They're more in tune with something going on. They're very interested in that. They may not talk to a lot of people and tell them about what they do. It's a very personal thing. And I've really enjoyed meeting a lot of plant breeders, because they and nursery people as well, because many of them had other jobs that they were doing, especially the small nurseries. And some of them were ministers, some of them worked for the car companies, some of them were engineers, some of them were multimillionaires and worked in had manufacturing companies. And there's many people that want to have a nursery. There really is. And I think part of it is, I'm like, well, why do you want to produce this and throw yourself into this very rough and tumble market of nurseries, but they do. And I think part of it is just it's like opening a restaurant. You know that there's going to be the Paneras of the world, there's going to be the McDonald's, but you feel you can make something really delicious and offer it to people in some way. And nurseries are very much like that. So I just would like to say one thing about your if you start a nursery, just a couple of technical things I always encourage people to do. And as one is think of a very good name for your nursery, something that's that people will remember, and is use your likeness if you can. Trademark, protect your name. Get a nursery license by the state that you're working in. The nursery people, especially the plant inspectors, they were my lifesavers because I could tell what was going on behind the scenes as far as regulations go, because regulations are off the chart. And then finally, there's a place called the National Plant Board Regulations, and all the states are in there. And it's kind of interesting to read those sometimes. Not that I love regulations, but like Kentucky, I think, has 2 pages, where California has over 100. So you can see the difference on what people think is a threat to their agriculture. And I just encourage you to do everything by the laws as much as possible. Let's see, I was going to say something else about the. Oh, yes. So there's one thing that I'm very strong in on is ecology and agriculture. There's many ways that you can bridge these two things within permaculture, and there's a personal way that you can do that too. And there's these small discoveries that no one knows about that will be of great value, and you should write about it, even if it's not within your genre of plants that you're selling. It's something that you like. Maybe it's a particular flavor of a weedy plant that grows that you made tea from. Someone recently told me about a weedy plant that grows in their gravel driveway, and they said, geez, the tea from that is so tasty. I think it was called pineapple weed. I'm not familiar with it. But anyway, but it just goes to show you that people find things that are delicious and healthy, and even though that may not be what you're interested in, maybe you should say, well, look at my this discovery, this treasure I found in nature. And that's kind of been my attitude for the last since I retired, because I don't have to worry about the nursery anymore. So okay, so let's get started, and I'd like to show you some images and some ideas of different plant populations that I made repositories of that you could do a similar type of thing with other plants as well. So,
Yeah,
want me to
that's
go to the
perfect.
share thing here?
Yep, do the share thing. And the question so far that we've gotten is, how do you prefer calling it echoes or oikos?
It's oikos. Yeah, that wasn't that wasn't the best name.
Yeah, well, that's where some of your advice is kind of coming from. It's like
Oh
you're.
yeah, don't listen to me too much, but the thing was
You probably had to
the
answer that question a million times on
well,
your
what
time.
happened was it was the yogurt company. When
Oh,
they
yeah.
started advertising Oikos yogurt, it took the pressure off. But prior to that, I was desperately trying to change the name. And I think it was my accountant who said, you've had it this long, it's too much hassle to change it. You have to go through all this stuff. And I go, yeah, you're right. And so I just kept that name, but it was a yogurt company that made it pronounceable for people.
Yep.
And it could have been pronounced Ecos or Oikos, and it was just driving me nuts for a while. But thank goodness it's over. So thanks to the yogurt company.
That's right. Make
Yeah.
sure you hit from the beginning, and then otherwise it looks good.
Okay, hang on. There we go.
Yep, perfect.
All right. So what we're going to do here is just take a peek at some of the few crops that I know about and I've discovered in a process of just growing plants from seed. So let's see. How do I? Okay. Forward. One of the first plants I knew about in Michigan is the thimbleberry. And the thimbleberry, this one was taken, picture was up in the Keweenaw Peninsula. And you see there's just a few fruit here and there. And I really loved that, the flavor of that. And as I grew the plant, I realized in southern Michigan, it wasn't productive. I could not get them to fruit. And so I started using other seed sources from California, where it's very hot and dry in higher elevations in the Sierra Nevadas. And so what happened was more and more fruit set in this process. So I ended up with a lot more thimbleberries. And so this is a good example of taking a plant from one geographic region and moving it to a new one in the pro in trying to find a plant that is more productive in your region. Now, you would think that the Michigan thimbleberry would grow well in southwest Michigan, but it doesn't. It never fruits or rarely fruits. And it's just because of the adaptability of these plants from different locations here in the United States. So that I thought that was a great find. Personally, I love thimbleberries. So, and I think that the jars of jam are like 20 some dollars for a little pint, you know, very expensive. Another group of plants that people brought to me just from around my farm were peaches. And this was a peach brought over from a Latvian family, planted in their yard, and I started to grow it. And it was true to seed. So all the plants looked exactly like this. And having a repository of these domesticated fruits like this is can be great value. In this case, no insects, no disease, very furry fruit, as you can see, and very healthy, very delicious fruit too. There's one that most people may know about is the Iowa white peach or the white peach. This one is happened to be from Texas. It ripens in October, and this too was very productive in quite a good colony. This came from Texas, but it was from a botanist who had discovered it. And he sent me pits of it, and I grew it into at my farm. In that particular case, just to give you an idea on time frame, the thimbleberries took probably 10 to 15 years to really squeak out the population and plant them on my farm. The peaches took maybe 10 years or so to really understand what I had found. One of the plants that I worked with a lot was Jerusalem artichoke. And in the beginning, there was like three varieties that I knew about. Like there was Stampede from Johnny's and a few other ones here and there. And so we started growing them at the farm and tried to find seeds of them, create seeds from what is really thought of as a sterile plant. And what happened was, is as we brought all that diversity together, seeds began to be produced in great amounts. So instead of we'd have like a shopping bag full of seed heads, and we would get like maybe 10 or 20 seeds out of it. And with this, it was we almost got, I think, up to 2 ounces of seed. And it continued for many years. This was quite a labor of love in some ways, but I also really wanted to find better sunchoke varieties. And so what I ended up with was a huge diversity, and it was kind of hard to choose, like, is this any better than the other ch sunchoke? And so I did find some selections that were more agreeable to cultivation, where they're clumpy tubers, and some that did seem to have higher fructose levels that were more delicious. And I also found more and more wild ones. A lot of times when you grow these plants in your yard or somewhere close, you'll be driving around and you'll see them more and more. And the sunchoke's one of those because it's usually along roadsides that you'll spot them. Okay, going some sunchokes with ding dongs. The reason is The average American diet is not good. And so these types of foods are available. And you're telling the people that eat ding dongs that they should eat sunchokes. And so you have to have a way to make it, when you're writing about it, okay, this is part of, this could be part of your diet and it's healthy for you. At the same time, it has a good flavor. And someone sent me a picture, a freezer filled with sunchokes. I think it was maybe 20 some pounds of them. Not everyone's going to be eating sunchokes like that, but people have figured out ways to cook them now and ferment them. And so you get to see, and this is part of your job as owning a nursery, is to educate people how they might enjoy these things that you're growing. And here, this is a good example too. The choke cherry that we know is very powerful, sugary, or astringent fruit, but processing can make a very delicious thing. And I was able to create a small repository. Now, this repository wasn't something I really found necessarily, it was from another nursery. So there was a guy who had a nursery in northern Montana named Clayton Berg. And I bought a bunch of choke cherry plants from them, planted them at my farm, and those were really amazing. They're still fairly astringent, but it shows the variety of fruits that can be found in wild populations. And then to cook with them, you do get different flavors that way. And these types of plants are excellent, just as a wildlife plant too. One of the big things that I had at my farm was a plum collection, and I used different forms of the beach plum and other plums and created little hedgerows of them. And this proved to be not only very easily to do, but it was created a good seed repository for people to use and plant. So that was one. Here's a what's called a Dunbar Eye plum, which is a beach plum, American plum cross. One of the wild crops the last couple of years I've been fiddling with is hog peanut. And what I didn't realize is when I was doing this particular grow out that these seeds were actually edible and there was a lot of them. So what happened was I was growing it for the tubers, but the seed production really increased. So now I'm kind of focused on this nitrogen fixing legume and seeing if I could grow it enough to make a bowl of beans from it. So, and here's the tubers. This is a variety that I gave a name to called Crispy Snack, and has larger than average tubers, and it's quite delicious, really, the beans. But this little group here, I think I spent maybe a good 15 to 30 minutes to find in the soil this is the problem with it when we were selling it, was the soil adheres to the outer part of the bean. So it's totally camoed. It looks like a chunk of soil. And eventually you'll get really good at eyeballing those chunks of soil because sometimes just a little purple or yellow will pop through. And but it still takes forever to collect. I don't know how people, but I keep experimenting with it a little bit, and I think I've discovered that it might be the mycorrhizal that would help with that. So next year I'm going to try that. Another one that's kind of in that same area is the thicket bean, and I started growing a lot of those. It's a Native American bean, mostly found on the East Coast and all the way throughout Central United States. And it's quite an amazing little plant. And I started growing it and hybridizing it with the lima bean. So I was trying to create a larger seeded selection. But even as it is, as a wild crop, I still think the thicket bean could be something that you could grow commercially in some way. But no one has really ever, you know, if you read these books on different, many of the different wild crops or wild beans or legumes, There's nothing that anyone mentions about the food quality of them or how they taste. And so that's one of the things that I always pride myself on trying. The issue with the thicket beans was the cost. It's like it's literally around $500 a pound if you're to buy them. So it's not a practical bean to eat a bowl of, but it's very delicious bean. The other thing I began to work with was domesticated plant is the potato, and using true potato, and I used blue heirloom seed potatoes, and did that over a period of 20 years. This was a new group that I'm trying now, and I'm trying to find more rhizome type potatoes that spread that compete with grass, so they can be like a wild potato, and you'd have it. And so, oops, go back. This rhizome on the left here, you'll see, is kind of gives you an idea of the way that those would spread from a central tuber and be able to compete with grass. So that's the whole point, is that we can't always be cultivating anything so pristinely, like with herbicides and everything. Could we have a weedy potato field or potatoes that could grow amongst other things? And it's through these diploid tomatoes that you can make selections and do this sort of cultivation under a permaculture setting. And same with corn. With corn, corn drives me crazy just because it's so uniform. And so I was wondering if you could find or create a corn forest where each plant is genetically different. And I did. But I also, there's a cost to that. But you can see the three different kinds of corn here. On the left is more of a popcorn. The middle is more of the teosinte cross. And then on the right is a sweet corn. And each of these types of corn are all on one cob. So it's not like it's all one type. All of it is blended. Even the cobs are all mixed up. So it's very confusing. And here's some of the results of that. And what you'll see in this type of grow out is it's so diverse. You could say I ruined it. Go ahead. But the idea was that I ruined it for a reason, is I wondered if corn could be more of a grass plant and less of what we know it of it is. In other words, when corn evolved and when people started growing it, they pretty much abandoned the teosinte. And my thought was, well, can you go back to kind of a medium ground where you have a great diversity of corn cobs, so each one is different and hard to recognize? And I finished up with pretty much this portion of it, and then I'm going to have it analyzed for its nutrition, because I got a feeling that the nutrition is very good. I've made cornbread from it. It was quite good, actually. So, but I don't know if I've really created anything new. But again, in the spirit of permaculture, I wanted a weedy plant that was compete with other things, and really it would be something as a sideline crop where you could harvest some of it and make a gruel or a paste from it to make chips or tortillas or something. And here's some that are really pretty purple. It's a really beautiful plant. So, my father worked for the post office, and his passion really was our tree farm. And again, the Christmas trees you can see in the background there. And he bought used. This is a used tractor he bought, and this type of cultivation for tree crops brought in a lot of interesting plants. My dad never used herbicides too much, so there's always a lot of other types of plants around them. So when we were pruning them with our pruners, I'd look down and then I'd get out my identification book to try to figure out what it was that was around the trees. Now, one of the crops that is mostly clonally propagated is from groundnuts. There's a real demand for groundnut seeds, by the way, if you ever want to grow those. The groundnut is usually a high protein tuber crop that is found in a lot of wetlands in North America. It's been distributed by the Native Americans many all over the place, and it's quite fascinating to me to grow it. It's a delicious crop. I understand some people can't eat it. A percentage of people can't consume it, but it's we had a big collection of those for a while, and we grew it in like a flat 8x8 beds that were just basically sand and compost. So they're only planted maybe an inch or so under the ground, and then they spread laterally. They don't go down. It's the opposite of sunchokes. So when you go to harvest, you would just pull up the strings and they'd just come up in huge amounts. So that was a good crop. I think it was more profitable than sunchokes because it was easier to store too. Oh, and this is my great grandparents who came here in 1911, and they went to the Sebring area in Michigan to pull sugar beets. And my grandfather came first, and while he was there, he made enough money to send back money for his family, which included my grandfather. And that's how the Saginaw Asmus Group got started, was from him leaving Russia. They lived in the Volga region, Russia, and at that time, there was all these promises being made from the government, which didn't come through, and they felt that it'd be better just to go to this new place called the United States of America. So, and of course, one last thing here, I met a lot of beautiful people, very attractive looking people here. Look at that! Wow. Anyway, so. This was really one of the better things about my nursery was I got to meet a lot of different people, employees, including customers. It just tons of stories and very, very good times, despite cranking out lots of plants. So, all right.
Yeah, it's Trevor Newman,
That's
Michigan
right. You
guy.
recognize him.
Yeah, I remember Trevor. I haven't heard from him in a while. Is he still kicking around?
No, he's got a new job,
Oh, okay.
a new company.
New company, right on. Well,
Yeah.
thanks, Ken. That was a really lovely. I really
Great.
like how you framed the first part in terms of like bringing your art into it and like
Yes.
having your business be so full of your personality that it's
Right.
unduplicatable, you know?
Right.
I love that.
Me too.
So we got a couple questions in here. Let's take
Okay,
a
good.
small break though. Let me give you just a 60 seconds, Ken. I'll
All
take the
right.
screen share over. I want to share something with everybody coming up here. And then we'll get into the questions. So I mentioned that we're going to be doing a million tree challenge coming up soon. I won't talk about that one again, but I did want to say that the next summit that we're going to do, we just recently voted on it. It's going to be in 3 months, so in May, and it's going to be the Community Development Permaculture Summit. And so we're looking for volunteers, people. Basically, that's how we populate our summits. Anybody who's willing to raise their hand and be like, I've got some experience. I wouldn't mind teaching on that. If you've had any, or you know of anybody who's had really good success with community development projects, whether they be nonprofit, urban, inner city, connected to Native American populations, they be rural, basically, have you done a bunch of permaculture blitzes? We want to hear from people who've have models, kind of like with the nursery summit, that we can then share with other people and like advance their learning so that they can quickly learn community development skills as they're starting to understand their permaculture work. So organizing the resilient future, I think we always need more skills at that. So that's coming up. I'll drop the link in the chat. And if anybody knows anybody, send them my way. If anybody wants to raise their hand and volunteer, we're all ears. We would love to hear from you. So thank you guys. I'll share the link in a second. And then let me ask you a couple questions, Ken. So
Sure.
Ben asked about your plums. Are any of your plums resistant to black knot?
Yeah, so almost all of them are.
Oh.
So there is that was one disease. It just ravaged so many things. And it was very fortunate that I got access to enough seeds of this Japanese plum that I grew it out, and it just killed several thousand seedlings. You know, in my beds, my nursery beds, which were 50 by 4 foot, I could raise about 2,000 to 3,000 in one bed. And we had many beds of these Japanese plums. And when that black knot came, it just wiped them all out completely. But all the native species here in North America, for whatever reason, are immune or highly resistant to it. I can't think of an example. Once in a while, those chokeberries will get black knot, but it's not prevalent. That's the only one. The rest of them are completely immune or show no signs of it. I'm
Cool.
sure that black knot, knowing black knot, it's probably living in some minuscule little cell on the plant. But I had this one plant that was very popular and very worthwhile growing was slow plum. And that wiped but I had 25 different plants. And from that, I ended up with maybe three that showed no sign of it. So I was kind of, it's like dodging bullets with diseases sometimes. Yes.
Indeed. Beth asks, have you gotten into milpa ecosystems?
I don't know that.
The Mesoamerican, I think I looked it up. It's the Native American traditional Mesoamerican agriculture, three sisters being the main one, but agroforestry, polyculture, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, that would be something to look into. The one thing is that you're planting whatever it is, it can be whatever you want it to be. And there's a certain flexibility, as we all know, that nature is very flexible. And my discoveries now are related to the things that seed into my farm. I'm very curious about that. Like I 2 years ago, I started getting woodland flowers growing on my farm. And I was like, well, this was a pasture. Where did that come from? And I have quite a few American beeches too now. And so I'm like, where does that come from? How do those things get there? So there's a change, the land can change. But as far as the actual style of agriculture, like the milpa, I'll look into that more. But I feel I'm doing some of that already by using resources that are adaptable to my location. And if things fail, then that's okay too. But I'm not sticking to North America. I'm using the world's plants at this culture, all cultures, all agra, all plants, all culture in my planting. So it's not native only. So that's not really one of my goals, but it sounds very interesting. Thank you for bringing that up.
And it was related, Beth. Follows up with it's helpful for corn diversification, and it was during you showing your corn work
Oh,
that she was thinking it could help with that.
well, I'm going to have to check that out. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Beth. Good one. Here's an interesting question from Ryan. I'm embarking on a collaborative small scale cold hardy PCNA, I don't know what that is, hybrid persimmon breeding program
Well,
using
that sounds
dominant.
fancy.
Yeah, it does sound co using dominant Kakia PCNA genetics from China. Any recommendations for efficiency in seedling selection as far as tree spacing for initial fruit production?
Okay.
Does that land?
Well, yeah, now that's that. Now, okay, so there's two things. One is when I hear that, I glaze over and I'm like, oh no, that poor son of a, he doesn't know. But then at the same time, I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to create varieties. And I don't, I think in the selection process, this is going to sound a little funky, but I would kind of go to those my seed beds on some things where I felt that that plant in some way inside me, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just something special here. And I don't know how to explain it, but sometimes it's like you're seeing into the plant itself. It's like this is going to be a good one. Now, having said that, there are some plants that produce a lot of side branching, and the side branching is very good indication of fruit production. And I had some plants that were so productive in these side branches, they died. There was too much fruit. There was not enough foliage. And I started on other plants, the fastest growing plants, the ones that they're most vigor or had bigger leaves. Those that was like a given, like, oh, this is going to be good. Now with persimmons, it might be a male tree too, but someone had told me, oh, male trees grow faster than female. Well, that's not entirely true. Maybe initially, but eventually there's many female trees that produce huge volumes of fruit that are just as big at my farm. I planted roughly, I think it's close to 1,000 or a little more, but it was 4 foot spacing persimmons around my farm. So I have a 1,200 foot row of them, and then I have another 400 foot row in the back. And there's the spacing maybe 7 feet apart or so. They're really packed in there. And so I had to come up with some sort of system of selecting. And really, for that, they were so uniform that I just tagged plants from each group. So it was maybe Killen or John Rick or some other variety that I was getting seeds from, that I was purchasing seed from and growing. But the other aspect was the cold weather here in Michigan, looking for plants that drop their leaves early without disease, looking for disease-free plants that don't have specks on them, especially with persimmons. There's this one disease that just defoliates them and weakens them. So I did that, and I looked for the bigger leaves, strong growth. If it's twiggy, okay, I'm going to plant that out. But if it's too twiggy, but it works. It does work. And that has worked for me with beech plum in particular. But the persimmons, that was a very uniform group. But I would say, kind of just don't get in a rush to plant things out in a traditional breeding program like you're doing. Give it more time. People are always in a rush with the breeding.
Yeah, that's good advice. You mentioned something about like you see into the plant. That reminded me of Luther Burbank and like how he could sort of like has this sixth sense about plants. Can you talk about that? How do you develop that skill as a nursery person?
Okay, this is another weird thing. And it's weird because I've talked to other people and they would go, other nursery people, and it's happened several times, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5, and they'll go, they will be talking, and all of a sudden they'll just like drop a bomb. Like they'll say something that you go, well, that's what happened to me. And it's almost like a response back from the plant. And I don't know how, for me, my technique is a transcendental meditation. So I practice transcendental meditation twice a day. But I do feel that gives me going to the source of nature, going to my own source. We're connected on a deeper level with the plants. But plants don't care about your philosophy, really, but they do care about your feelings and your emotions. I think that's probably the connections that you can get, but it's not very obvious sometimes. But then other times, it's like a slap in the face, and it's very noticeable. You're like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? But with me, it's more or less looking at the plant's health and understanding the plant's health. But sometimes finding the seed plants far away in the distance, I'll be able to see them far away. And then I'll be driving and I'll go, there it is. And I'll spot it. And it's uncanny. I'm always surprised about that.
Well, it's
But it's
kind
just
of
because we're looking for it. We're
right.
looking for it. If your wife is pregnant or a friend of yours is pregnant and you go, oh, you're pregnant. Boy, that's something, and you see it. Then pretty soon you're driving around and you'll see more pregnant people, and it's just natural because you're tuned into that.
Yeah,
So that's.
the reticular activation system, they call it in science nowadays, where it's
Oh,
like, I
really?
bought a yellow car. Now I see yellow cars everywhere.
Oh.
But Stephen Harrod Bruner, in his book Secret Teachings of Plant, goes really deep into the electromagnetic sensing organ of the heart, which I find to be like maybe the closest corollary to these nursery folks, yourself, Luther
Yeah.
Burbank, who are able to really like perceive what the plant is trying to say. It's like this two-way communication thing.
It is.
So if anybody's interested in that book, highly recommend it. It's very sciencey, but it like does describe this mechanism, I think.
Huh. I'd be interested in reading that.
Another question about the potatoes. And also, how can people, since the nursery's closed, can people still buy plants from you, Ken?
There's a few things. I don't like selling stuff. Sometimes if people show up,
Go home with all sorts of stuff.
sometimes, yeah, if I happen to catch me on a good day,
Yeah. That's
but
fair. You've done it long enough.
yeah, it doesn't work selling it. I don't like to do that, but I have contributed to different groups some excess nursery stock that I could still yank out of the ground in the spring once in a while, or a school or a
Yeah.
university. Sometimes I'll do that. I like doing that. It's fun to give it out into the public.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give away of the surplus. A question about the potatoes. That really struck me here. Like potato fields that can grow in and amongst grasses or other mixed
Yeah.
species.
Yeah.
How would we start on our own journey toward that? What would you recommend for us to duplicate it?
Well, the best way that really there's if you go to there's a website. I sell the potato seed too, but there's another website called Cultivariable, and Bill Whitson is his name, and the guy is like potato seed crazy. He's
Okay.
very smart. He's a plant breeder guy. I feel sorry for him, but that's okay. No, I don't. But anyway, he's very good breeding potatoes, and he's got like lots of seeds and stuff where you can buy these diploid seeds. And so that's kind of a good starting point, really.
Okay.
There's also some heirlooms, like All Blue and so forth, that naturally will produce some fruit. And that's how I got started, was just some heirloom potatoes I was growing. And I go, look at that, we got fruit, you know? And that's how the russet potato got started. It was fruit from a potato. Now, potatoes are, I guess, male sterile or something. So they don't usually produce fruit. So it's hard to find a variety that produces fruit consistently. But I have one that
Okay.
I've selected just because of that.
That's cool.
But it's fun to experiment with that, and then also look breed a winter hardiness that they could come back year after year without having, you could leave them in the ground even if the ground froze.
Okay, cool. Oh, thanks, Keith, for the link in there. Well,
Okay.
last question I have for you, Ken, and then we'll let you go.
Okay.
And that is any perma not permaculture, any nursery related books that you would recommend to somebody just starting in the nursery adjacent plant
Oh yeah.
growing business?
Yeah, this book here I found out about in the library called Seeds of Woody Plants,
Okay. Never heard of
in the
that
United
one.
States in agriculture. This from growing from seed, it really is fantastic. I mean, there's just so much good information in there. It's reprinted now,
Okay.
so that is good. It's number 40, 450. That's one book that I really enjoyed to learn how to grow seed. The other one is Michael Dürr, Manual of Woody Landscape Plants. Very nice book. This particular book has from seed in the back, underneath, or excuse me, on the bottom of the directions, and then it tells a little bit about the cultivation of the plants. Like that's another aspect. You go, geez, why can't I grow that here? Seems like I should be able to. Well, some plants are just not adapted, to the soils, no matter what you do to it. But both of those are very good books for the seed production part of it. And then, of course, I also have my favorite catalog. I just will say this. Shout out to J.L. Hudson Seedsman, of
Yeah.
course. And he mentions in here, just to kind of cap off, that in 1962, when he bought this seed company, there was over 15,000 species and varieties that Henry Sayer was using in his selling here. This was here in Michigan before it was moved to California, and David bought it. And today it hovers around 1,000. So what does that say
Wow.
about biodiversity? We got to get on the stick, because now is the crunch time. We need more biodiversity of all crops, everything from the ground up. And modern agriculture is not doing it.
Nope.
Permaculture is. So that's all I got to say.
Amen. That's a great way to end, and I think we all agree with you here, Ken. Thanks so much for
Yep.
sharing your wisdom and your time with us. We greatly appreciate it. I
You
hope
bet.
to see you and all the other presenters at the round table at 5:30 p.m.
Okay.
Eastern time, just to clarify.
All
And
right.
thanks, Ken. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you at the next one with Michael Skeeter-Pilarski. Looking forward to that one.
Oh,
Everybody
yeah.
take care. Bye, Ken.